Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George W. Bush has three more years in the White House, and that is suddenly looking like a long stretch. The polls look lousy. His own party is divided. His policies on war, on deficit spending, on Social Security, and much more are in trouble. A new poll shows more than half the country, 57%, think the Bush administration has low ethical standards and that the president is not honest. On his right, Pat Buchanan says that the Bush presidency has left the GOP in crisis. On his left, Jimmy Carter says Bush has compromised fundamental American principles. In the middle, Americans see huge challenges and trouble in the White House and wonder what next. This hour, On Point, three more years of George W. Bush and what they may mean for the country, his party, and the president's legacy. You can join the conversation. How do you look at three more years of George W. Bush? Has he delivered what you hoped for or what you feared? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We will hear in this hour from the Conservative Weekly Standard and Bush One staffer James Pinkerton. But first, joining us now from New York is Hendrik Hertzberg, political essayist for The New Yorker. He's former editor of The New Republic, was a speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. He's author of Politics, Observations and Arguments, 1996 to 2004. Rick Hertzberg, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Jack.
Rick Hertzberg, so what do we have here? You've seen the poll numbers. They're lousy all over the place for George Bush. The list of things undone or stalled is very long. Is this, you've been watching for a long time, is this a typical second-term bog or something particular to George W.?
I think it's something particular. It's not quite like anything that I've ever seen before. It's true that there's always been a kind of second-term blues for pretty much every president that's managed to win a second term. This feels rather different. I think what's happened is that the inadequacies of this particular president have caught up with him in a big way. And it's very difficult to see, partly because of that, partly because of the nature of his policies. It is rather hard to see a way out of this for him.
You say inadequacies of this president, Rick Hertzberg, but of course for years George Bush was lauded for his leadership, for standing up after 9/11. He was reelected just 1 year ago by the American people. So the inadequacies you're looking at?
Well, the inadequacies were always plain to me. They were visible before September 11th. And to those who cared to look, they were visible after September 11th, but we didn't want to look. We wanted to. We certainly didn't want to. When faced with a crisis like September 11th, one that looked like and still looks like it will continue for the foreseeable future, we did not want to think that we were stuck for the next 7.5 years or 3.5 years with an incompetent. But Bush, as was widely noted when he was, not elected, but appointed in 2000, is extremely inexperienced, somebody who had never been serious about public affairs, who had been kind of a ne'er-do-well playboy until he was in his 40s, and who simply is unfamiliar with American history and with most of the subjects that you need to be somewhat cognizant of if you're going to be an acceptable president.
So there's the experience critique, the competency critique. What about the basic posture or attitude or worldview of this president? How do you see it playing out now in the fifth year of his presidency, Rick Hertzberg?
I don't know, because it seems to me anyway, and this is really in the realm of speculation. It's not something that you can prove. But I find it hard to believe that Bush really has a well-developed ideology the way Reagan did. I think he's got a set of resentments, basically, and a set of passions or feelings that have more to do with his relations with his father and than they do with political ideology or any kind of analysis of society. So I really don't know. He seems to have been driven by these sort of kind of substitute fathers like Cheney, and I just don't know who's going to be guiding him in the next 3+ years, or if anyone.
And let's make it very plain, Rick Hertzberg, because we're going to hear a conservative defense, I'm guessing, of President Bush. From where you sit, what is your fear for the moment, the past the country's come to now, and the prospect of 3 more years of this leadership, of this presidency?
Well, what worries me and what I've heard from many, many friends is something a bit bigger than the usual deploring of an administration run by the other side, by the party that represents the other point of view, or the other
from yours anyway. Yeah.
From my point of view, yeah, it's a little different from that usual complaint. I fear a kind of national decline, and I usually deplore these sort of comparisons with the Roman Empire, but I do see the possibility that that America's best days are behind it, and the question is, I certainly think Bush has contributed to that enormously, and this administration has been a decisive factor in heading the country in a downwards direction. The question is whether it will be possible to right it and to correct that in a future administration, and I certainly hope so. I certainly hope so, but I'm beginning to have my worries that the damage done by this administration may turn out to be irreparable or permanent.
In the face of global competition, in the face of global challenges,
yes,
of all kinds. Jack Beatty, join us here. We look back to Ronald Reagan. Of course, he had the Iran-Contra scandal in 1986, but he got a new White House staff, went for better relations with the Soviet Union, kind of changed the theme music, the focus anyway, and revived his public standing, and the first Bush presidency followed him. Presidents can come back from second term troughs. What do you see for this president, Jack?
They can, and I think as Rick suggests, Reagan had a compass. He had a direction, so that even when he varied from the direction, it was with a sense that he knew where he was going to come out in the end. As with Gorbachev, the trouble with Bush is, you know, he's in a sea of troubles with a false compass to guide him and fake stars. The Myers nomination, I mean, it revealed the degree to which he's surrounded by sycophants. He said he doesn't read the papers, apparently he doesn't watch much TV news. He says he relies on objective sources of information, his staff, which means toadies like Myers, who's called him the most intelligent man she ever met. And apparently people who bring him bad news, we've learned, he snaps at them. Now, this management model put him about 2 days behind the rest of sentient humanity on the bad news from New Orleans. He's deep in Xanadu. That's the word that George Reedy, LBJ's press secretary, used to describe the cocoon world where beleaguered presidents retreat to. But with Bush, and this gets to what Rick was saying about his private struggles with Bush, Xanadu is not only a bubble against threatening reality, but against threatening self-knowledge. He's been throughout his life an upward failure, and saved from one disaster after another by his father, and now he's in the one job from which he can't fail up.
Rick Hertzberg, Tom Friedman, New York Times columnist, no liberal, writing last week that he sees this in a broader context, not just of George Bush. Those are my words in his mouth, but he really frames it more broadly. He says that there's a yawning gap between the huge problems our country faces today and the tiny, fragile mandates that our democracy seems able to generate to address these problems. He says it's really profoundly worrying. But did that begin, Rick Hertzberg, with George Bush? I mean, is Bill Clinton, was he taking on all the the big beasts out there, and Bush is the first one who hasn't?
No, but Friedman. I didn't see that particular Friedman column, but that I completely share that sentiment. It certainly does not begin with Bush, and we have a political system, a system of levers, of hydraulics, that is inadequate to the modern world. And that's been true for a very long time. We have a creaky, essentially 18th century political system, which was a magnificent piece of political technology when it was designed. It was the state of the art, but it has not been sufficiently updated for modern use. And what Friedman says is right. Our government is like a huge dinosaur with a tiny brain.
But it's ours. It's our democracy. Tom Friedman says he finds himself, and he feels sick about it, envying the Chinese Communist Party that can pull levers and make things happen. But surely that's not the model we're looking for here.
No, it's exactly the opposite of the model we should be looking for. I think we should be, we personally, although it'll be highly unfashionable to say this, I think we should look more toward European models, toward democracies that have been designed more recently than ours, where you can have where government is much more accountable and much more unified and vigorous, and can act in a coherent manner, and then be judged on the results.
For a parliamentary system, a vote of no confidence, is that what you're yearning for?
A parliament, not exactly, not a British parliamentary system, but a European kind of parliamentary system. Yes, I mean, it should be possible when a government is as abject a failure as this one is, it should be possible to replace it.
We've got to take a short break. Hendrik Hertzberg, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking about 3 more years of George W. Bush. You can join us. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about 3 more years of George W. Bush and what they may mean for the country, for his party, and the president's legacy. You can join the conversation. How do you look at 3 more years of George W. Bush, of President Bush? Is the nation coming to grips with its challenges? Where has this presidency brought the country? And what's happened since the president won re-election just 1 year ago to push these poll numbers so low? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined from New York by Hendrik Hertzberg, political essayist for The New Yorker. Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, is with us. And right now from Washington, we're joined by Stephen Hayes, senior writer for The Weekly Standard. Stephen Hayes, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be back with you.
It's great to have you. What's your assessment of the president's moment here? The polls look lousy. He's getting torpedoes from the right and from the left. At The Weekly Standard, you and Bill Kristol have been writing Fight Back, Mr. President, but I guess even you would say he's not fighting from the best footing he's ever had.
Not fighting from the best footing he's ever had, and he's not doing so as vigorously as I would like on some of the charges, particularly with respect to these claims that he deliberately lied us into war. I think taking a step back and looking sort of broadly at where he is right now, I do think it's sort of a grim moment for him. I mean, the Harriet Myers nomination was a debacle. It, I think, undercut some of the faith in that people on the right had built up in the president and his decision making. Sort of a I'll do what's right for the country. Critics be damned. I have good judgment on these things. I think he earned some of that, frankly, with the decisions he made after September 11th and how he led the country after that crisis.
That's a pretty big statement, but you're still on board with him? I mean, Pat Buchanan, who of course is no friend of the Weekly Standard camp, say this guy's a disaster for the GOP, the greatest strategic blunder in U.S. history, the invasion of Iraq, twin heresies, he says, neoconservatism, read Weekly Standard, and big government conservatism. That's a different angle of critique from yours, I guess, Stephen Hayes.
To say the least. I'm not on board for everything the president does, and I never have been. But I think on some of the big issues, I think responding to terror, cleaning up the mess on international and global terror that he was left when he took office, I think he's done a good job, by and large.
Bombings in Oman, bombings in Britain, bombings in Spain,
There were bombings in Amman before President Bush came to office. There was a plot during the millennium that involved Abu Zubaydah, the operations chief for al-Qaeda, and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leading terrorist in Iraq today, the person who's believed to have been responsible for the most recent bombings in Amman. So this is not a new phenomenon. It's certainly getting more more coverage, and there are, I would say, we're on a different level of the war on terrorism. But
or of terror itself, I guess, if you look at the numbers. We look at Republican pollster Bill McIntyre, if you know him, of course. He says there's a kind of pall in terms of the American mood. To what do you attribute that, Stephen Hayes? Is that of George W.'s making? Or, I mean, you see the poll numbers, you must see the pall Bill McIntyre's talking about. What are the roots?
Well, I do think you know, George W. Bush is ultimately going to history will sort of approve him or not approve his job performance based on what happens largely in Iraq. And I think the failure of the administration to fight back on these questions that have been really, you know, had their roots in the 2004 presidential campaign and have continued until now, these allegations that he deliberately misled the country into war. The failure of the president and the White House not to respond to those leaves people who might have supported the war or those in the middle of the American political spectrum to believe that they're true because they've gone unresponded to. And I think that has had a tremendous effect. And until they fight back, I think, more strenuously than we've seen them do thus far, it will continue to have that effect.
Of course, there's the war itself and how it's going and not going. What about your level of confidence or concern, fear, about three more years of this administration? Do you think they'll pull out of this, Stephen Hayes? Or do we have, as Pat Buchanan says, a crisis for the GOP, maybe for the country here?
Well, I think they will, you know, if these December 15th elections go as well as the previous two elections go, that is certainly a step in the right direction. The problem that faces the administration and certainly the military on the ground in Iraq is that we haven't seen political success translate into security success or fighting the winning the battles with the insurgency. And until that happens, I think this will continue to be a struggle, and we will continue to get headlines from Iraq that are not helpful to the Bush administration.
Rick Hertzberg, what about this core issue of the president's honesty? He came into office talking about integrity, and now 57% of Americans say they don't trust him or his White House. Stephen Hayes says essentially, that's the result of dishonest attacks on the origins of the war. The Americans don't seem to be reading it that way in the majority now, Rick.
Well, I think people cling to the question of whether he's honest, whether he lied, because that's an easier question to get your mind around than the larger sort of strategic questions. I don't know. I tend myself to doubt that he kind of consciously lied us into war, but even if there had been no dishonesty whatsoever involved in it, there'd still be the question of whether this was a wise piece of statecraft. And I think it's undeniable at this point that if at the time of the invasion of Iraq we could have projected ourselves forward and seen what the situation would be now as a result, that war would not have been undertaken. Certainly, there would have been a completely different approach to it. This is not what we had in mind. This is not what we wanted. The situation that we face now, where we are in a seemingly a war without end, a quagmire of sorts in Iraq, where it does not seem to be doing us any good at all in the struggle against terrorism. It has been a political catastrophe for the United States. The United States and the leadership of the United States is now despised and hated around the world as never before. Our alliances and cooperative relationships with other countries have been grotesquely undermined, and Iraq has now become the new Afghanistan. Afghanistan itself has been neglected and is in danger of tipping back into a kind of chaos. So I don't see, it seems to me that this war was a very unwise piece of policy. people went along with it, and most Democrats went along with it. It had the approval of most Democrats, and I myself was very ambivalent about it. I ended up being weakly against the war at its beginning, but without much sureness at all about it. But it's much easier to understand their lying than their unwise.
And now here we are with, by most accounts, no great way to stay and no great way to leave. Rick Hertzberg, Stephen Hayes, Jack, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Let me turn to them. Leo's calling from Raleigh, Massachusetts. Hi, Leo. You're on the air.
Good morning. It's a fabulous show. This is my dream come true. The Republicans have run their flag to masthead. We've got an executive that's out of control. One of the first things that was done was to amend the Freedom of Information Act to include the vice president. There's gross incompetence and cronyism.
And this is your dream come true? That's what you dream for? That's what you want, Leo?
Well, I wanted the meat and the marrow, the bone there of the indulgences that, just like it came out in the past, the shortcomings of welfare state or becoming too liberal, getting way too far to the right here. The flag is at the masthead. We've got corporate welfare with the contracts in Iraq and Katrina, and we've, in a nutshell, been duped into Iraq by the neocons.
So this is your dream come true because you want that flag shot off the masthead.
I want this stupid liberal conservative thing to stop, and if people start looking at things objectively. I mean, if we don't, we've had it.
Leo, we've got it. Stephen Hayes, how about that? Weekly Standard comes with, as do people from many angles here, with a big ideological head of steam. There's a lot of talk now. We talked to John McCain last week about the sort of reemergence of a majoritarian view of the world, a more centrist American view, more pragmatic, less ideological. Are you ready to strike the ideological colors and go for that?
Well, I think that's the caller makes some interesting points, but is overly simplistic on a couple. And I don't think that the ideological question and pointing to the neocons, the quote-unquote neocons, has become too easy and doesn't often make as much sense as people suggest. I mean, there was an article, I think, in the New Statesman recently that talked about Goering as a neocon. Well, that doesn't quite fit. There are, I think, a wide variety of views on the right, as evidenced by your citation of Pat Buchanan's critique of the administration. And there are places, as I say, where the neocons, where people at the Weekly Standard don't agree with the administration. So I just think it's a little simplistic.
But of course, of course, he's summarizing. But are you guys at the Standard ready to get off your ideological high horse and look for a kind of pragmatic central ground here, less polarized? Is polarization itself, which George Bush has helped drive, part of the problem?
I would say that we're not. I would dispute the premise. I don't think we're on an ideological high horse. I think we believe that ideas have consequences, that ideas matter, and that by following through and creating policy based on those ideas, you improve the country for people, even like the caller. And I think, to a large extent, the way that we've conducted foreign policy and national security policy, notwithstanding the fact that I agree with some of Rick Hertzberg's critiques, has in fact made us safer, and we would do well to continue along that path.
Well, it's tough to keep both Rick Hertzberg's view and that perspective in mind all at the same time, but we're working on it. Dave is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm glad I got a chance to get on. A couple of points. One is, I think that President Bush is authentic and really believes in what he says and doesn't contrive very much, and I think that's often missed when we have intellectual discussions. He is appealing because of that. Politicians are, by and large, mistrusted quite a lot.
So that's still a plus for you. You're not with the...
It's a little plus because his... Are you there?
Yes, I am.
His ideas and vision are something which are so despicable to me, more than any politician that I've ever known in my life, and that was preceded the death of my son, 16 years of age, who I think in part I could say that President Bush is the reason for my son's death, because my son at 16 was so impassioned with Egypt and who'd been there several times, and he wanted to go for a third time to study Egypt, And 2 years ago, they said it was too dangerous. And so we changed and we went to Peru, where we had to take a malarial medication, which I didn't want to and wasn't necessary really, but they said we should.
And he died from the medication.
A very rare side effect. And
I mean, it's a long stretch from President Bush, and we need young Americans out in the world, but you're saying he's honest, but not honest in a way that you respect or that you trust.
In America, it is difficult to travel in the world, and I send children all over the world to try to bring the world together, and Americans are not valued like they should, and it's scary, and that makes me very sad because Americans are wonderful people.
David, we're sorry for your son's loss, and we thank you for your call. I want to bring one more voice in here. James Pinkerton joins us. He's a columnist for Newsday, regular contributor to the Fox News Channel, worked in the White House under Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. James Pinkerton, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Dave calls in. He says the world has become an unfriendly place for Americans on George Bush's watch, and it's got him upset and angry. Is he justified in taking that back to the president?
Well, he put a pretty intense twist on there with a tragic tale of his own son. It's sort of hard to react to that. I would say that certainly the data from the Pew Center on international opinions and attitudes would suggest that there's been a sharp decline in the positive view of America around the world. So in that sense, you know, there's something to worry about. However, it is worth remembering that 9/11 happened, you know, in a different era, long before the Iraq War, and so there's sort of the negative feelings people might have towards America, and then there's the actual sharp spear point of a terrorist attack, and they do have to be both borne in mind.
You saw the Ronald Reagan and Bush one presidencies up close. Is this presidency, George W. Bush's, an heir to those? Is it a departure? Is it a radical departure? Are you happy with the direction of this president?
I certainly think that he's not that George W. Bush is consciously not like his father. I think that's very deliberate in his mind and very clear. And the kind of
Oedipal dynamic Rick Hertzberg was referring to.
I think so, yeah.
Is that good or bad for the country, for you and
me
and all of us?
I think that it's the big test, and I agree with what Stephen Hayes was saying, that the big test of the Bush presidency and everything else that Bush does in his presumably 8 years in office will pale next to the Iraq War. If the Iraq War is a success, then Bush's presidency will be judged as a success, and if it's a failure, then Bush's presidency will be judged as a failure. And I think the administration is increasingly willing to make that gamble with history, if you will, in terms of, I think Bush has now pretty much set aside his domestic economic fiscal agenda, pretty much letting that be, you know, horse-traded in the Congress.
But that is a lot to set aside. Let's put it aside for just one moment. First, just on the Iraq War, do you think that the United States can come out of this war with a success? I mean, we've had a parade of people we've talked to from all points on the political compass saying there is no success here anymore. It's the best worst scenario is the best the country can hope for.
Well, I oppose the war going in, and I'm skeptical now. But I guess the one thing I have learned, and just watching President Bush for the last 5 years and American presidents for all my life, is that sometimes they can use that famous phrase from the New York Times magazine last year, they can kind of bend reality their way. If the president can go to China, for example, and work out some arrangement with them, and go to India and work out some arrangement with them, in terms of oil in the Middle East and arrange balance power in the whole Eurasian subcontinent, then I would imagine it's still possible that some sort of larger macro political settlement will occur, probably involving a lot of Arab input into Iraq. I noticed with interest that Saudi Arabia, who many people think of as the great funder of terrorism around the world in terms of the so-called Wahhabi sect, just promised to put in $1 billion, into Iraq. Now, most people would think that's going to go to the Sunnis, and the Sunnis, of course, are the heart of the insurgency in Iraq. And so one is going to be a little curious as to, you know, how the Saudi Arabians will actually spend $1 billion in Iraq, assuming that's even true.
Or very curious. We've got a big pickle growing there. James Pinkerton, Stephen Hayes, Hendrik Hertzberg. Jack, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We'll be right back. Listeners, you can join us. What do you think? Will the GOP majority outlast this president, or will he sink it? And what do you need from this president now? What might turn his fortunes and the nation's around? What will the legacy of W be? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about three more years of George W. Bush and what they will mean for the country, for his party, the GOP, and for the president's legacy. We're joined in this hour by New Yorker essayist Hendrik Hertzberg, by the Weekly Standard senior writer Stephen Hayes. James Pinkerton is with us, a columnist for Newsday and contributor to the Fox News Channel, was in the White Houses of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Jack Beatty's with us. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Where has this president brought us? Where are we headed now? Scott is calling from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How y'all doing today?
We're good. What do you think, Scott?
Man, I'm just wanted to put a comment before everybody on the air. I'm glad you had this topic to talk about. I think it's really going to require one hell of a fix-it, man, for the next administration and probably the administrations to come to undo all the damage that has been done by this president and its administration over the last 5 years. And that goes over the whole spectrum of things. I mean, everything from foreign relation to the economy to the environment to the massive difference between the haves and the have-nots.
Scott, were you against him from the outset, from the get-go?
You know, I was, because I just looked at him as an oil man trying to be the president, you know?
Did you think for a while somewhere in his first term that maybe it wasn't so bad, or he just didn't suit you all the way through?
Well, like most everybody, I think when 9/11 happened, you get behind the guy and you go, and you hope for the best. And but you know, so much can be attributed to that event in history. But there's so much that can be attributed to basically his ideology. You know, the big words.
Yep.
There,
yep.
That he wants to, you know, put across to everybody. When basically it's the whole corporate thing that's driving this, you know.
And you're not having it. And we've got it, Scott. Thanks for calling from Savannah. Is that Jack?
Yeah. You know, I think he goes too far there. I mean, you know, the environmental degradation has been with us for a long time. The Clinton administration really ran away from the whole challenge. That's why Ralph Nader challenged Al Gore, because it had essentially punted on global warming and on the environment broadly. The gap between the have and have-nots, that is a dynamic in the world. That is an aspect partly of trade, partly of technology, worsened by the Bush tax cuts, but by no means created by them. I mean, I think that the Bush disaster, I mean, I think it's been a failed presidency, but I think we can easily overstate its damage to our, certainly in our foreign relations, that's hard to overstate, but it's domestic damage. It's very hard to, we can easily overstate that out of a kind of, you know, presentism and myopia. But if you look at the trends, these things have been running against us, or been running, our leadership hasn't stepped up to these challenges for a long, long time.
Rick Hertzberg, how about it? Are you willing to look back at the Clinton presidency and see it as a, I don't know, a precursor or setting the stage for Bush, or one of a piece? Is that fair?
No, I don't think so. I think actually a lot of social indicators edged upwards during the Clinton years. Income inequality narrowed some. There was illegitimacy decline, crime decline. You know, a lot of that's for demographic reasons, but I think that this. I'd be curious to know from our friends Stephen and Jim.
Yes.
What they think the domestic legacy, or in what way they think this administration has improved American life domestically. I mean, I agree with everyone that the foreign issues are going to override everything else in the ultimate judgment of this administration. But you know, domestic life does have some interest and importance, and I wonder what they would say about the way in which this administration has improved our country.
Let's ask Stephen Hayes, how about it? I mean, you say it all hinges on Iraq, and maybe so, but we're laying the groundwork for the competition of our lives in this century, and a lot of people are worried about how that's going to go. What about Rick Hertzberg's challenge? Where do you see George W. Bush having improved? Has he improved America's domestic circumstances?
Well, it's a good question, and I'm sure we will all be on different sides of it. I think one of the things that the president actually doesn't get enough credit for are those tax cuts that came at the beginning of his administration. I mean, when you stop and look back with the benefit of hindsight and look at the tremendous economic damage that could have been done, I think, after September 11th, and we sort of flirted with recession.
So a short one and a shallow one, but then everybody looks at the twin, the deficits now headed back toward 5% of GDP. Is that the partner?
It is the partner, and I think there's no excuse for it. I mean, I'm sure my friends on the other side would not agree. I think the president should have been much, much more aggressive in going after spending reductions.
But if those things don't balance in some way, then how do you make the case that the country is net better off domestically? I mean, isn't it a wash at best?
And presumably the stimulative effects of the tax cuts would be completely undone if you match them with spending cuts.
Well, I suppose that we could debate that for quite a while. I don't think that that's necessarily the case. I don't think one necessarily follows from the other, but certainly if the president had, even if he delayed a more aggressive reining in of spending, and certainly not bloated, I think, federal budgets in certain ways. I mean, we all have heard the sort of starting statistic to those of us on the right that spending has increased at a greater clip under President Bush than it did under President Clinton.
Do you think the country's better off domestically, to use Ronald Reagan's question, than it was 5 years ago?
Given everything that has happened to us domestically, I do.
Pretty big proviso.
It is a pretty big
proviso. In what way is it better off?
Well, I think we have made strides towards addressing our national security, homeland security. These are things that I think throughout the 1990s, the Clinton administration, along with Republicans in Congress, didn't pay much attention to.
Jim Pinkerton, what's your sense, Jim? The domestic situation, Rick Hertzberg's question, how do you respond to it?
Well, I would say that the real GDP, the gross domestic product of the country, grew by 3.8% last quarter. That means that the economy will double in total terms in about 18 years. That's a pretty remarkable growth rate in spite of 9/11, Iraq War, Katrina, the dot-com bubble, which President Bush inherited. I would say that the tax cuts have been a tremendous help to the economy, and not because of Keynesian deficits, but because they've increased so-called supply-side incentives for savings and investment. And we're going to have don't take my word for it, we're going to have a test about how the economy does when these tax cuts start to expire later on in this decade. And I suspect that given the current climate, the Republicans will be hard-pressed to make those tax cuts continue, and so we'll see what happens when the capital gains tax rate goes from 15% back to 40%. We'll see what happens to the economy, and I suspect there'll be a recession.
Well, of course, all kinds of factors are going to be converging around that. Let me get one more call here. Eli's calling from Salem, New Hampshire. Hi, Eli. You're on the air.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm well, and what do you think?
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the subject is wide open. If you talk just about economy, you don't think it doesn't seem like he's doing an excellent job.
Well, we're hearing just the opposite right there. But what do you think overall, Eli, of this president?
This is the best president we ever had.
Why? On what basis?
On what basis? On tracking down the terrorists. If our economy is booming and we have terrorists in our backyard, what good is going
to
do us?
I see here you're an immigrant from Lebanon. You saw what happened to Lebanon in the 70s and 80s. Do you think that might happen in Iraq? Is that good for American security?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
I mean, what if Iraq turns into another Lebanon, into another civil war environment? Is that good for the United States?
Well, in Lebanon, we have different issues. We have the Palestinian who create our problems. We have the Syrian who never thought that Lebanon exists. They thought Lebanon part of Syria, and they always kept Lebanon under their occupation. We've been under the Syrian occupation for a long time. And thank you for President Bush. He's helping us. And thank you for all the Americans who support us.
So there's the vote of confidence in President Bush from the immigrant American. Eli, thank you for your call. Rick Hertzberg, you said something earlier in passing, which is a pretty big thing to say. You're worried. You know, it's the old Roman Empire fear that America may have seen its best days. It's not a dynamic Americans like. We've just got a couple of minutes here, but what are the elements of that? I mean, do you really mean that? Do you think we're on the downhill slope and it's W's fault?
No, it's more of a mood, and I have no idea whether we're truly on a downhill slope or not, but it certainly worries me. I think that we've done a pretty bad job, that this administration's done a pretty bad job in combating terrorism. I think that that a Democratic president would have done a much better job, wouldn't have gotten us into this Iraq mess, would have devoted much more resources to strengthening our internal defenses against terrorism. But I think that the long-term political sclerosis of the country is always a threat. It's always a threat to us, but it's gotten worse and worse and worse. And I do see a real Democratic small d deficit here, and we'll see some of that perhaps in the next congressional election when by all rights there should be a change of government, at least in the legislative branch of the federal government. But there probably won't be because of the inability of the system to translate that into seats.
Redistricting and all the rest.
Redistricting, which has become a science that prevents that actually actively inveighs against democracy.
Here we got Stephen Hayes. In a nutshell, we've just got a few seconds. Do you think that the GOP is going to prosper on the other side of this president in the midterms in 08?
Tough to say. I think the redistricting. The redistricting helps the Republicans, although I share Rick Hertzberg's disdain for it.
And there it is. Jim Pinkerton, Jack Beatty, Stephen Hayes at the Weekly Standard, and Rick Hertzberg at The New Yorker. Wonderful to have all of you. Thank you very much for being with us in this hour. Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, remembering a giant of business, management, and more, Peter Drucker. This is On Point. Peter Drucker, the Austrian immigrant who revolutionized the way the world does business, died Friday night at his home in Claremont, California. He was 95. In his six decades as journalist, teacher, consultant, and author, Peter Drucker emerged as a pioneering giant in the understanding of business and society. He taught generations of corporate leaders and urged them to give workers more control over their work. The Wall Street Journal today calls him the first philosopher of management. Last December, Peter Drucker joined us at On Point to share some of his warmth and wisdom. Our conversation spanned business and politics, and then we took a step back and looked at where this guiding light thought the world was headed next. Peter Drucker, you're so generous with your time. I just have a couple more questions. You're a wise man and an old man, and there's certain kinds of questions we're always tempted to put to a wise old man.
No, I'm not wise, I'm just old.
We'll be the judge of that. There's a lot of unease today, I sense, among Americans about where the country is headed, about where the world is headed. So, my wise old friend, what do you think? What's your sense of the direction the world is heading? Is it all right?
Well, I think anybody who is not uneasy about the direction in which the world is moving is blind and deaf. The belief in progress, which we inherited from the 18th century, is gone. The belief in a Western-dominated world is going. The new world is emerging, with China and India, by no stretch of the imagination, are the Western, nor will they westernize themselves the way Japan did 150 years ago. We don't know the extent to which a European Union will actually become a union or remain a loose confederation. We are in a period of transition as fundamental as the 18th century, before the Napoleonic Wars. So, not to be uneasy about the direction of the world is being blind and deaf. Certainly it's going to be a world that is not going to be dominated by any one great power. That's going to be a very difficult thing to accept for Americans. Most of us still see a world, the world of 1860, in which America was the only great power. Today there are, while the European Union is a bigger economy than the U.S. economy, the Asian Union, China, is trying to build a Chinese free trade zone that will be bigger than America. India is rapidly emerging as something quite different. So we will have to learn that it's going to be a very different world, and the world in which different values will have to coexist. It will have Western values and Western productivity and Western competitiveness, and it'll be held together by information, not by power. That is the direction we are going. It's going to be a very difficult and rough transition time.
Peter Drucker, I have a final question for you. You've lived a long life and focused intensely on life. Now you're 95. What about an afterlife? What about God? How do you think about the moment of transition that you are inevitably approaching?
Well, I happen to be a very conventional, traditional Christian, period. And I don't think about it. I'm told, not my job to think about it. My job is to say, yes, sir.
That must be very comforting.
It is. And I say every morning and every evening, praise be to God for the beauty of His creation. Amen.
Peter Drucker from a December 2004 interview. Peter Drucker died Friday night at his home in Claremont, California. He was 95. To hear the entire interview, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.